if you remember when there was the H1N1 flu, there were some governments worried whether, city governments worried whether, hey, is COVID back or is it just the flu? Do we shut down schools? Do we shut down airport? And Precision was able to reveal that, okay, you know, you can calm down a bit. It's actually the flu. It's not really COVID. You'd be even able to inform doctors that, look, you know, these antibiotics will not work because most people are resistant to certain antibiotics. So the tool itself, you know, with hot spotting, geographical, and now with the climate overlay, we're able to warn people in advance how they should protect themselves, when they should protect themselves, when they can be calm and, you know, less cautious perhaps, and how they might even, doctors might even treat them.
Hello and welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. I'm your host, Gaurav Chaudhary. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, investors and businesses and professionals who are disruptors yet not in your face. The disruptions have consistently delivered on the purpose and the mission they've embarked on. Their values, of course, are as strong as the mission. While they're ruthless in pursuing their ambition, they don't stray from being leaders who are not just admired for their vision and relentless pursuit, but also for how they're building an ecosystem of believers who consistently push the boundaries. They allow principles to take precedence over ad hocism. For them, profitability is as important as scale, creating and leading new categories and innovations and impacting and touching lives. In each episode, I speak to one such leader, talking to her or him or them about their businesses, their lives, careers, inspirations, interests, challenges, pivot moments, starting points, turning points, successes, failures, agonies and ecstasies, and of course, the little joys of life. It is as much about their personal life stories as about their entrepreneurial and professional journeys. Unusual Suspects streams on earshot.in, spotify.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, moneycontrol.com, and a host of other podcast streaming platforms. For this episode, I'm delighted to have Angela Chaudhary, CEO, Swasti, the Health Catalyst, a global public health nonprofit focused on adding a million healthy days to the lives of the poorest and the marginalized by 2030. Angela has led and mentored global programs and teams that translate public health science into meaningful community action for equitable change. Her work with at-risk adolescents, gender non-binary groups, people with HIV, and other conditions across continents reflects her rallying call to leave no one behind. Over the years, she has worked to help countries raise more than $1 billion in equity-centric programming and strengthen community systems. Welcome to Unusual Suspects, Angela. Delighted to have you on the show.
Thank you, Gaurav. I'm very privileged to share this space with you and very excited about what we're going to talk in the next few minutes.
You know, let's start off with a very basic question. You talk about bringing back healthy days as an outcome metrics as people-centered health systems is the need of the hour. And I think that's a no-brainer. We all know that. Help us understand this. What does this entail in your work?
Thanks, Gaurav. Well, let me take you back a few decades. When the movement for everybody will be healthy started, and I'm going to simplify it for non-public health people, which is called as universal health coverage, there was an Alma-Ata declaration. People went to Almaty, the then capital of Kazakhstan, and said that everyone has a right to health. That itself was a pivotal moment, because as soon as you declare the right, it becomes every government's duty to ensure that anyone can demand right for health. And then there's the WHO definition of health. What is health? Right? It's not just only physical, but it's mental, social, relationships, it's and just not merely the absence of disease. So then what happened seemingly was all the doctors and the medical professionals and the health system started measuring whether a Gaurav or an Angela is healthy or not. Do we have anemia? Do we have diabetes? Do we have hypertension? Do we have X, you know, Y, Z disease? And it became about an external measurement of our health. And essentially, it became about, is it an absence of disease? The exact same thing we said that it should not be defined as. And there was a lot of primary importance on that and continues to do so today. Now, in my work, and you very gracefully mentioned Swasti, we work with the vulnerable people. And, you know, vulnerable people are those that are not seen by the system or not understood by the system, are, you know, just eking out their livelihoods in such a way, just basically surviving, that they aren't able to really look at a holistic picture of themselves or even have a futuristic, you know, sort of vision of their lives. And here is where we said, hey, you know, if we say that it should be people-centered and go back to the definition that health is just not merely an absence of disease, then there needs to be a better metric for it. Then comes 2018, the Astana Declaration that people put people bang in the center. And so what does that really mean? We want to understand if people are feeling healthy. Simple story. A year ago, I was feeling really terrible. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I'm a doctor, but I still didn't know what was wrong with me. Because if I took apart piece by piece, I did a complete blood work, went to my gynecologist, went to my GP, did even a cancer check because, you know, I was thinking maybe there's something in my history that might give me something, and everything was clear. But I was still feeling awful. And I said, okay, what do I do with this? Because the doctors were asking me, so what is your blood work like? And I said, my blood work is clean, but I still feel awful. And this is not the way I feel. And so we went back to say, what are some metrics that gives us an idea of what it means to be to measure people-centered well-being? And there seemed to be something already that exists that was used by the US, I kid you not, for the insurance system called Healthy Days. And essentially, it was about the quality of life. I'll pause here, Gaurav.
It's very interesting because in your own personal anecdote actually makes it even more significant on why we need to have healthy days in all our lives. You do mention about the vulnerable groups, and the way you described it is those who are clearly unknown and nobody's doing their bidding. But I want to, you know, change tack a bit just to narrow focus it. How do you measure and research the experiences of people living with multiple health conditions and economic and social influences on their health? I ask you this question because we generally tend to underrate or oversee the role of social influences on the way, you know, they actually shape our health. Essentially, how do you measure the social, cultural, spiritual, and economic determinants of health, Angela?
Thank you for that question. It's really very simple. It's not something that, you know, sort of we invented. As I said earlier, there are measures that are existing already and tested worldwide. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in the US, have a tool called the Health-Related Quality of Life, HRQOL-14. The European Union has something called EQ5D, EQ3L, that all essentially measure about, are you okay? How many days did you think you were fine? Physically, how many days did you think you were fine mentally? Did your status get in the way of your usual activities like work, study, housework, family, leisure activities? Were you in pain and discomfort? Were you anxious or depressed? And various gradations of it. And it's really just time-tested tools which have just lost flavor with the advent of diagnostics and medical-centric measurements. Which we feel should be brought back again. It's still used in corners of the world. It's not that it's completely taken away. And there are studies that have proven that have measured this tool. For example, I will ask you, and that's how I will measure, right? I can just ask you, hey, Gaurav, tell me, did you have any problems in walking about? No, slightly, moderate, severe. I'll ask you about self-care. Did you have any problems washing or dressing yourself? None, slight, moderate, severe, things like that, you know, problems about usual activities. So you may not be able to pinpoint oh, I have diabetes and therefore I'm not able to do this. But as a human, as Gaurav, are you able to answer those? When you're able to answer those questions, I can very easily say that you're doing better off than last month or the last 14 days or getting worse off. And that's a wonderful signal for me to say, okay, there are these things that we need to work on, and I need to build your resilience. What this essentially does is it doesn't say, okay, you know, Gaurav needs to get a blood test done. But what it tells me is that something is happening in your life and you need help. In that help, it could be that you get a medical check. It could be that I refer you to someone. It could be that you just need to talk to someone, right? And in that process, I build your resilience, that you recognize that this is your journey. You are able to say, oh, I'm better off this month. Maybe I have these skills. And very much a part of you and your family. Your family should also know this journey and be able to support you. And that's what we mean by holistic health. We're not inventing anything new. We're just saying, hey, there were these good tools. There's massive amounts of research done. Bring them back again if you truly believe in people-centered healthcare. And that is a very ambitious goal, Gaurav, because to be frank, it's just easy to get a diagnostic test and say, hey, this is a number, you need to do this. But Angela and Gaurav will not have a wonderful well-being journey if they don't take care of everything else where we live in.
Absolutely. No, I think at some point in time, I should also reach out to you and get my own tests done in terms of these parameters, because sometimes I get this feeling that I've gone absolutely crazy, and I'm not joking. I need to, if I get these key determinants marked out for me, probably it'll help us. Also, you talk about, how precision health helps establish, various, some kind of an early warning system through key markers, and particularly for communities and city governments. I would assume that this early warning system can, these governments, the city governments and also communities can use to strengthen their response and improve the overall public health ecosystem. So if it is strengthening the response mechanism at the community level or at the administration level, that's a massive help. And we have seen that during the pandemic also, why that is required. But just to briefly, understand for our listeners and myself, how does this work, Angela?
Sure. Thanks, Gaurav. That's a good pivot. We were talking about the concept of listening. In our earlier conversations on Healthy Days, it is about listening to the people. And like you said, I will give you a tool. It's a self-assessment tool, and you can listen to yourself and know how many healthy days you have. Precision health is about listening to the systems that are around us. So essentially, it started off with the one premise that in the early days of COVID, there were some diagnostic tests, and people like you and I knew where to get them, could afford transportation to go get ourselves tested, and we knew whether we had COVID or not. Now, because of my work with vulnerable communities, we knew that they just did not have A, awareness, B, the tools and means to even know whether they had COVID or not, and C, that they had to go out and work in settings that were risky and bring it back to their family. And given poor nutrition and everything else, we didn't think that had a fitting chance to survive. So we said, okay, what exists out in science that we can replicate and adapt so we know what the COVID risks are? And in came environmental surveillance. Essentially, all of us poop, all our poop goes somewhere, and we're able to track in our sewage what are the viruses and diseases through the remnants, the viral remnants, to say, okay, are we going well? Is there a risk? Is the curve going up? Should we all be wearing masks, or are we safe? So essentially, that is it. It's nothing, again, it's absolutely nothing new. A lot of countries, including India, do it for polio, but it hadn't been, sort of expanded to other things. And then Netherlands, KW, or Water Research Institute, very famous eminent institute, tried that with COVID and said, yes, it works for COVID. And then my friends and I got together and said, might it work for Indian drainage system, because it's, a lower middle income country, does not have sophisticated drainage system like Amsterdam. And we proved that there is. Then we went and located, where are the big slums located? Let's go there first. And with the Bangalore Bruhat Municipal Corporation, we decided to map that out. And again, make it unscientific in the sense that not unscientific, but demystify what that science says to ordinary people to say that, am I at risk or not? And, you know, strengthen that with communication systems and working very closely with government. So people were able to say, and even journalists like yourselves were just able to look at the dashboard and say, hey, today I'm safe. Uh-oh, there's a thing coming up. Looks like there may be a wave. Let me wear my mask today. It's essentially about powering human beings at their core to make those right decisions because they have the warning ahead of time. And you know that there is a cluster going on right now as we speak. 91 cases have been found in Mumbai. Singaporeans are back to masking. There's a new subvariant out. It's very early days. We don't know if the hospitalizations are going up yet, but we do know that the viruses are increasing. And having this information, which is so quiet, so hidden, so simple, because taking it from, I'm not collecting any samples from you. I'm collecting it at a population level of waste. And I'm able to say, hey, is this the time for us to, you know, warn the doctors? Is this the time for us to warn the hospitals? Should communities start wearing masks? Very simple things like that. So that's what Precision is about.
Absolutely. And, you know, you have developed a national level COVID surveillance through the wastewater-based epidemiology, WBE. What has the data revealed, Angela?
The information that has been revealed so far, we are in five cities, Lucknow, Jodhpur, Trichy, Trivandrum, and Bangalore, and expanding further. And what it essentially says right now is that we are at a low level of threat. But throughout the last, from 2020 to now, it has given us several warnings. In fact, anywhere between 3 to 7 warnings that there is COVID around still. Excuse me. And we didn't just limit this to COVID. If you remember when there was the H1N1 flu, there were some governments worried whether, city governments worried whether, hey, is COVID back or is it just the flu? Do we shut down schools? Do we shut down airport? And Precision was able to reveal that, okay, you know, you can calm down a bit. It's actually the flu. It's not really COVID. We are even able to inform doctors that, look, you know, these antibiotics will not work because most people are resistant to certain antibiotics. So the tool itself, you know, with hotspotting, geographical, and now with the climate overlay, we're able to warn people in advance how they should protect themselves, when they should protect themselves, when they can be calm and, you know, less cautious perhaps, and how they might even, doctors might even treat them.
Interesting, because, you know, if COVID is back and we are probably not paying attention to it, I think we should better do. And Angela, ensuring community-wide health has also got a lot to do with participation within and among communities. And there cannot be a better exemplification of that than what we all saw during the pandemic. What's your view on this? Because without people's participation, all attempts by people, organizations like you, people like you, the government and the administrations will actually not do much, cannot do much. Angela?
Thanks, Gaurav. And it ties again back to the single point of being able to listen and create platforms for listening. So, you know, just collecting information from the climate and the sewage it's a good step, but it's not enough if you don't listen to the voice of the people. We were able to catch clusters of dengue, clusters of typhoid much in advance because we put together a measure where we were able to get patients, people reporting these symptoms. And oftentimes, people from slums don't immediately go to the doctors when they're sick. They just try to rest and self-treat. But knowing these clusters also tell us, hey, it looks like there's something going on and we can send professionals there. So it's not only when we say voices of the people, it's not only the people themselves. There was a time we were starting to hear various symptoms, especially because of the famous heat wave of Bangalore. The heat waves are across the country, but Bangalore has really reacted to the heat wave I would say in a humorous but also concerning way. Yeah. And there were a lot of people exhibiting viral-like infections. And so we released the platform very quickly and disseminated amongst professionals, GPs, and all the doctors available saying, hey, are you seeing clusters of this? Because we want to tie in granular information. People say, yeah, you know, during climate, you know, malaria goes up, dengue goes up, there's heat exhaustion, etc. But we don't have enough studies in our country with granular information. And who best to give you other than people and people's carers, like doctors and nurses? And that is where the voices of people is extremely important. It's informal. It's not formal yet. There are reporting structures, and reporting structures enters a formal system, which creates some delay. And for early warning, we just want to quickly, you know, hear from people what's going on, so we are able to act faster than sooner than later.
Absolutely. And what have been the lessons from the wastewater surveillance for pandemic prevention in low-income settings? You did mention about the vulnerable communities, particularly in the context of Bangalore, Swasti in Bangalore.
Gaurav, I think this is a system that should be there in all cities that have at least 100,000 population. Especially cities that are not, that don't have advanced health systems, for sure, but also cities that are like ours, you know, Delhi, Bangalore, Bombay, that are fast growing, highly populated, very dense, where any infection can spread like wildfire very quickly. Don't you think it's better to prevent than cure? It's more expensive, hard to handle, people die. And so a very cost-efficient, quiet system that warns cities is something that is the need of the hour. Now, we're not alone in this battle. There are many, many organizations that are working on this. There are many research institutes, and a few governments have actually started taking this on. And I'm just really waiting for, and we've had initial interest from state governments and partners there, but it still unfortunately has not been taken as a mainstream work. So I think my lessons would be that, you know, appeal to the sentiments of political leaders, because really there was a quick uptake when there was a threat, but now it is peacetime. And things like surveillance is not attractive during peacetime. So what is that narrative that one can say? Like, we pay for defense. It's not like India is at war every day. We pay huge amounts for defense. This is also defense. It's like an insurance. It's a small amount. It's less than 10 paisa per person, literally 10 paisa per person per year to be funding surveillance. So it's not like we don't have money. All our cities have this money. But somehow it hasn't been prioritized. It's anonymized, so I won't know if Gaurav has a viral infection or Angela has a viral infection. We won't know that, so no one knows. But there's enough information to warn us. And really, it's about the quick communication that goes out that empowers the community. These are the biggest challenge, really, is leadership.
Right.
And future, you know, visioning, foresightedness, and our leaders don't stay long enough, and that's really a challenge. And I wouldn't say it's an Indian challenge; it's a global challenge. I recently returned from Brussels. There were maybe 85 countries representing the world of wastewater surveillance, and it seemed like it's a political and leadership challenge. As you know, more than half the globe goes into referendums this year. And I'm really hoping that the new crop of leadership has more foresight to invest in very important things like surveillance.
Oh, absolutely. How difficult and complex is it to gather and document the latest intelligence? Because data updating is of essential importance, particularly on infectious diseases, because you cannot rely on dated data. And climate-mediated health risks, and there are many that we ourselves keep on experiencing in our own communities. This is important because updated intelligence and data is important for public health decision making. What has been your experience, Angela?
It's so easy. There's nothing complex. I mean, we run, as a country, we run large surveys like National Family Health Surveys and census and what have yous. And this is just one more source of information. We're all, like I said, we're already doing it for polio, right? At a central government level. Nothing stops cities from collecting these samples. We collect these samples to test many things. We just don't put it in a format that warns us. And we've created that digital backbone, not just the Precision Health team, but there are many others that are part of this journey. Gujarat has a few organizations. PG Chandigarh has done this as well. AIMS Delhi has done this, but they're all projects. They need to come together as a long-term investment. There is INSACOG by very eminent institutions, government institutions that test for genome sequencing. But it just hasn't been embedded in the local government yet to be able to quickly take actions. And all it really needs is some governance. It's the science part is solved. The problem is the governance and communication.
Angela, final question. The role of geographical information systems, GIS, because we are talking about communities here and vulnerable communities in specific locations. How can one use GIS to pinpoint risk-prone areas, and how have you been using this in your own area of work? And how has Indian communities or Indian administrations actually trying to use more and more of these for public health decision-making, Angela?
Thanks, Gaurav. Great question. You know those maps you see on the Weather Channel, and now you see the maps with the red spots and blue spots from the Indian Meteorological Department. That's all GIS. It's just warning you that this particular area is more prone. And when you have this information in your hands, it becomes quite imperative that you use this evidence as, say, a decision maker or a policy maker to say, I need to send resources in this district because this district is having acute heat waves. I need to send ORS packets. I need to train my doctors. I need to ensure this happens. During the COVID time, when we were able to spot areas that were more vulnerable, we were able to inform at a ward level where vaccination should be bumped up. Because if you have 100 syringes of vaccine, how might you prioritize basis age, gender, et cetera, but also locality? And so GIS is geographical, right? So therefore, pinpointing which geography is more at harm's way compared to the others and looking at the spread is something, is evidence that one can use to make very large and acute policy decisions. Very quick example, last month I was in, a couple of months ago, I was in Philippines and we were working with the mayor of Tabaco City. It's in Albay province. And they have an active volcano called Mayon Volcano. You know, there's a cute story. Mayon Volcano is like Mount Fuji. It's a pointed volcano. And they say that if you fly past it or you look at the tip, you become a virgin again. Just a side story. but most importantly, the mayor wanted to know, hey, where are my zero-dose children? Zero-dose children are those children who never got vaccinations. They were supposed to get at least one dose. Where are my COVID vaccines, you know, lesser than optimum? And where can I put the small resources that I have across my entire city? So we'd mapped all this information and we were able to say, you know, the areas closest to the volcano seem to have the highest tuberculosis cases. What resources have you given to the clinics over there? Because all the resources were mapped almost equally, but there are more cases in some places than the other. We could say that, hey, vaccination is least here, but there's also the most out of school girls in that area. So the mayor started making decisions based on locality, empowering those community health workers and putting more resources. Just a very clear, very short story to tell you how GIS can be almost immediately life-saving and helpful.
Absolutely. And that's a very fine example on how GIS can be used for community public health decision making and also enable vulnerable communities, particularly the targeted vulnerable communities, to achieve more healthy days and healthier days, as if I may say so. Thank you, Angela, for taking the time out and dropping by to have this conversation and sharing a deep insights and perspective with us. Thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure, Gaurav. It's been fun chatting with you this morning.